I will.
I love the picture.
Yeah.
Now what do we do?
This is
I think we have only two microphones.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's a great way to keep Jonathan or someone like him in check. There's only one mic and he can't interrupt you.
Okay, on off button is right there, and one for you two. And...
Yeah, we can check.
Yeah.
Put this.
That's right. Just want to turn away.
A little sad. Hold on, what do I feel?
Do, I don't know, do like Dr. Phil or something. So, what Tom just said, how did it make you feel?
A little sad. Very excited.
I'm going to record this, but without asking.
Well, you are in public, so I don't think there's an issue.
Well, the impeachment hearings are happening right
Lord
now.
Have mercy.
I was watching that this morning. Sure, sure. Do you want financials too?
Yes.
You send yours first, and then we'll give you ours.
Oh, no, my boss was saying you guys have to
send. All right, the little hand is on the one, the big hand is on the three. That makes it 1:15, and time for the first session for Mobile NewsGather, also known as Mobile Journalism, or Mojo for short. I'm Tom Butts, Content Director for TV Technology. Thank you for joining us today. A few housekeeping things. We're going to have probably about maybe 5 or 10 minutes at the end for questions, or anytime you feel like asking a question during this session, feel free to raise your hand. We also have some schedules in the back, at a glance, basically one piece of paper that allows you to navigate what the various studios are offering today. Thank you again for joining us. This is called Real News, New Technologies for Mobile News Gathering. And if you read the description, we didn't talk about in the headline exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about bonded cellular and the evolution of, we used to call it bonded cellular. We in the industry to cover, we're still not sure what to call it. We have called it, we call it IPENG. It's basically, using IP out in the field or anywhere you are to acquire and distribute video. Now, in ye old days of broadcasting, up until about a decade ago, when you had to cover a news event, you had to fire up the news van, and you had to fire up the satellite news gathering truck, and you had to get the breaking news. Now you don't have to do that as much anymore. There still are news vans out there, but they've taken on new roles, I think, in many cases. In the way that bonded cellular has seriously revolutionized not only the broadcast industry, but so many other industries. And we will talk about those today. We have a distinguished panel of representatives from the major developers of these systems. And I'm going to ask them right now to introduce themselves. Jim?
Hello, Tom.
Well,
hey, Jim. Hot mic. Hello, Tom. Thanks for putting this panel together. I believe you coined the phrase bonded IP.
Did we?
I think you did, and this might have been a few years ago that it's just more than cellular. It could
right.
be satellite, it could be a fiber connection. So I think you came
still
up with
a
that
marketing issue. You guys got to learn how to brand it.
Yeah. So I'm Jim Jaquetta. I'm the CTO of a company called Bitovation Corporation. And we are the master distributor for a bonded cellular or bonded IP provider out of France called AviWest.
Hi, I'm Chris Crump. I'm the senior director of sales and marketing for Comrex Corporation, a
little tiny company in Devens, Massachusetts, 30 employees, and we've been around since 1961, making audio for television and more recently, video product for television. And I'm fortunate enough to be one of the owners of the company because we're an employee-owned company.
And you're an audio guy.
Is it working?
Okay,
hey, I'm Fred Cole on the TVU. And I don't know if I like the term bonded because it doesn't sound. Yeah, it's not.
There, take that one.
Is this better?
That one's really hot.
I think it's out of phase.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, it's, okay. Yeah, there we go. Then, switch on. So the term bonded just doesn't sound right to me. I think of different things when I think of bonding. But, you know, we're in the remote news gathering business, and I'm looking forward to talking about what we do and what you guys are looking for and how we can serve this, this marketplace.
My name is George Kuttle. I'm the director of channel sales for North America for LiveU. We got our start in 2006 and actually built the first bonded cellular devices. Been around shipping products since about 2008, and we call it bonded cellular. We use it for everything from all the news gathering to education to corporate, etc. But I'm looking forward to participating in this panel. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to thank you. I'm going to start the panel off, and I'm going to throw these questions out to anyone, and you can anyone can answer at will. Some of you, your business has started based on bonded cellular. But what I want to know is, what impact has it had on your business, and how would you describe the evolution of it over the past 10 years? Jim?
Sure, that's a great question, Tom. So, Vidovation and our partner, Abby West, we've kind of shifted away from just the cellular, you know, more of the bonded IP, particularly where the pain point that we've solved is the at-home production, the REMI production. And one of the challenges is maintaining Genlock, frame-accurate Genlock, and lip sync over an unmanaged network. It's relatively easy on a managed network. If you have a dedicated connection, you can do precision timing protocol, you can keep all your equipment. If you're doing SMPTE 2110, it's part of the standard to keep everything in sync in Genlock. Now you try to do that over an unmanaged network like cellular, like the public internet. You don't own the network, so you can't maintain clock and Genlock. You can't really do precision timing protocol. So our partner, Abby West, uses a technique similar to PTP, but they do it over an unmanaged network where they're able to send timing signals, reference signals through the unmanaged network to the encoder at the origination point. And the video comes out in the studio absolutely perfect, down to the frame, perfect lip sync. So that's been a sweet spot for us. We've done some big projects with Turner Sports doing the Ryder Cup. We've done some soccer, or what they call football in Europe, some European projects. We've done a crazy cop show called Live PD, which has evolved into Live Rescue and First Responders Live, where they'll have 40 cameras out in the field. And when you're doing anything live, whether it's sports or these live reality shows, you have no post-production to fix the lip sync or to fix the Genlock problem. You know, when you're live, you're dumping it into like an EVS type of a playback system, and there's no time to correct before going to air.
So cellular, that's relatively new, isn't it?
It depends on how you define new.
Okay, well anyway, sorry. back in 1961, Comrex was creating products using licensed and unlicensed RF frequencies. And later on, we were actually able to use public switch telephone networks, plain old telephone service, POTS lines, to transmit high quality audio. So one of the things that we've always done is looked at the most widely deployed, widely leveraged data infrastructures on the planet to help broadcasters do their job. So when IP started to become popular in the late 90s and early 2000s, we actually started looking at creating an audio product that could replace ISDN. And we created one of the first IP audio codecs for delivering high quality audio over managed networks. But then the public internet was really kind of the challenge, and creating the technology to make that work was something that we spent a lot of our time and treasure on. So in about 2004, we came out with our first IP audio codec, and we spent a decade perfecting it. And some of our customers that had gone from radio into television were coming by NAB and saying, it'd be really great if you could take this thing and put video through it. And we were like, sure, why not? It's just data, right?
It's bits and bytes.
So cellular was really kind of one of those, the holy grail of having data anywhere you needed it in places that you couldn't normally go. Doing video over that, at the time we were looking at 3G and then the early parts of 4G, it seemed a little bit daunting to try and do that on a single network. So multiple networks and aggregating those networks actually became the thing that we needed to do. So we developed that for our video product first, then put it back to our audio product, and it's really changed the way we do our business. So to answer your question, it's been huge and transformative, but we're still kind of agnostic to data networks. We work on a private LAN, a private WAN, cellular, satellite, any kind of IP network, and we can aggregate them all and basically make the product work really well for them.
All right, thanks. Right.
Okay, so I think we started out with the idea that cellular transport of video was a replacement for the infrastructure we create with microwave, or for the expensive satellite systems that were out there in satellite systems. So we're looking to solve the problem. And in the time that we've been around and working with the broadcast community for gathering these, we found that they're basically looking for ways to get acquisition of video and then distribution of that content into your network and out to your customers. In addition to that, you're looking for ways to automate processes and find out this weird AI stuff. I'm not really sure what it is, but I know we can use it somewhere. So situations where you're trying to get video in, how do you manage that content? You know, if you go back to, some of you guys aren't old enough, some of you guys are, like me, and I remember when we went to school, you had to go to a thing called a library. Anybody heard of that?
What's that?
Yeah, I know. And you had to look in a reference book to find out about, the War of 1812. Now, you can pull out your phone, Google the War of 1812, and you'll get anything you want about the War of 1812. Right from your pocket. So I think what I'm trying to say is that we're trying to enable this marketplace with the ability to do the same thing our kids can do on their cell phones by in the market of collecting mobile news.
Okay, thanks, Fred.
What?
Yeah, and I think from LiveU's perspective, when we first started out in 2008, it was all about broadcasters, and the goal, as Fred just mentioned, was to really go after that market and solve the problem of replacing satellites with bonded cellular and transmit back to the control room, right? And today it's really evolved from 3G to 4G, now moving into 5G transmission, but it's also evolved from a product standpoint to going away from just broadcasters to having products that fit every single market from high schools to colleges to corporate environments and what have you. And the products have become agnostic in the sense, as Chris mentioned, and then even Jim, that they can all work on satellite, they can all work on Ethernet and Wi-Fi, and it's not just cellular, right? But that's the main piece of it, the main thrust. That's how it was kind of invented, right? Giving you the biggest pipe to get your signal through out over IP and get those packets back to you somewhere. And as Jim mentioned, the biggest thing I think for most of us, maybe for most of us, but at least for LiveU for sure, almost all of our productions today are REMI based and what we call at-home production as well. Whether it's the news organizations doing it or corporate customers like Toyota, they do something which is really amazing. Every single month they go to one of their factories around the country and they have multiple units of ours that they send the signal back for tours, that they do at these different factories and show how they save money and stream the signal back from the factory back to their control room, where they have a server, they have a full production switcher, replay, CG, Chiron, everything else, and then they put all the production together back there. They don't do fly packs anymore. They don't send people on the road anymore. And then they stream that out to their destinations worldwide so they can show how they're becoming more and more efficient at the factory level to all of their employees, right? And that's become the norm. It used to be really not possible or too costly to do that, right? And that's kind of the change in growth and the change in methodology that we've seen over the last couple of years. And again, moving now from that workflow and the more efficiencies that we're seeing with new codecs like HEVC and 5G coming to 4. So I think that's really what's new for us and what's been happening in the industry over the last few years.
George, you made a good point earlier on, is the fact that your first market was to go after broadcasters because that's the high end. If you please the broadcasters, then you've pretty much pleased everybody else. They're the biggest skeptics.
They sure are. They were the biggest ones in the, first off, our very first customer in the very beginning was NBC. And they came to us with the problem saying, and we went to them, and the solution that we had at the very first NAB was on a piece of plywood. And it said, we think we can do this, and this is how we're going to do it, and how we're going to save you money. And we showed them, and now CBS and all these other stations are retiring trucks. CBS doesn't even use any more, doesn't buy any more satellite time. They still have trucks, don't get me wrong. But bonded cellular transmission is literally replacing satellite trucks. I think all of you would agree today.
Anybody else want to add in regards to the kind of reaction you first got from the industry when you rolled these out?
Well, I think years ago, in the late 2000s, everyone had their CrackBerry, right? Their Research in Motion BlackBerry, and be like, Apple's going to make a phone and put RIM out of business? Where's BlackBerry today? So, 10 years ago, right, when we all said, oh, this is going to be a replacement for satellite, prove it to me. I think we're there now. I always tell a customer if they want 110% reliability, you probably maybe want to run a couple of fibers, have a fiber connection, but the even satellite is susceptible to rain fade. But before the panel, George and I were talking about lower cost solutions, and they have a lower cost product that they're pushing, to bloggers, wedding videographers, and we're doing something similar, where we have smaller, more cost effective solutions, using a technology that's been tried and true by the broadcasters. Now trying to do it, lower power consumption, smaller footprint, more cost effective. So I thought I'd add that.
In terms of over the past 10 years in regards to the equipment itself, how has the size, weight, shape, how has that affected? I'm sure that, the early systems that came out, you probably got feedback from customers saying, I want them like this, the ergonomics of it all. How important did that factor into it?
I'll go again. I don't want to monopolize.
You are, but that's okay.
You want to go first? You want to go first, Grant? Sorry.
Oh,
am I pulling a you-know-who?
Yeah, kind of.
All right, you go first, Grant.
So Moore's Law, we all know what Moore's Law is, and if you don't, it's that there are twice as many transistors, thank you, on a, you didn't say that, did you? Twice as many transistors on a motherboard every 2 years. So if you consider that fact, and you went back 10 years, the size of what we all had 10 years ago is relatively dwarfed compared to what we do now. Small pack, more power, more functionality in it. We've all got Remy solutions. We've all got cellular, microwave, satellite, Wi-Fi. We all have those solutions. But I think what's interesting is that when we're talking about changes and the broadcasters questioning what you do, when we started with the packs years ago, the transmitters years ago, that was, is this really going to work? Why do you believe this thing is going to go out in the field and put this data back? the story on TV and it's going to look good. It's interesting what we were talking about, Remy. You know, there's a lot of news gathering operations that you all do that include things like town halls and multiple meetings where you have multi-camera events, and you transport that over plain old IP and synchronizing the cameras, synchronizing the video feeds, return feeds, all that kind of junk. Like that. It's really cool stuff. And I swear to God, I had one broadcaster who basically said to me, I don't know if I trust this internet really. So I asked him if he watched Netflix, and he said he did. So he's heard of it.
Chris, anything you want to add?
So one of the early things that we were kind of faced with was dealing with small market mentality, thinking that they had to have a truck. But when they realized the cost savings of basically turning their truck into just a mobile journalist that was basically doing the story, running the camera, their own technician, making it simple for them was really key. So having a very small, simple package that they could power on, hit one button, do the story, that really kind of changed the small market mentality into how they can actually use this to their benefit.
How? Yes.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, you know, your question about size and how we've moved in the last 10 years. Our first backpack weighed 52 pounds, looked like a camping backpack you would go up into the mountains with, and you'd have to be pretty hefty like myself to hump that thing around. Today, our number one selling unit weighs about 5 pounds, and we even have a small unit that you can fit in the palm of your hand that weighs about 1.5 pounds. So it's really migrated as things get smaller and smaller and more compact, and you can fit more electronics into something now, as you were suggesting earlier, but it's really scaled down and gotten smaller and smaller while the technology's really gotten better and better. And we still have one of those packs in our offices. If you're up in our headquarters in Hackensack, New Jersey, you can come in and try it on and carry it around a little bit. But it's crazy how things have gotten tinier and tinier for people.
My dad, before starting Multidyne, worked for years in the industry. His last job was at NBC, worked at 30 Rock. And the joke was that, you know, if you took something the size of a refrigerator and put a handle on the side of it, it's portable now. You know, you might need four guys to lift it. So Abbey West, when they got into the market in 2007, 2008, they kind of took the form factor that you saw in microwave camera links, where you put the unit between the battery and the camera. So if you had an Anton Bauer rig, you'd mount the unit on the camera. So they were one of the first adopters in the so-called bonded space to put it on the camera. And as George alluded to, now they have smaller units. If you don't have a broadcast camera that has a V-Lock battery plate or an Anton Bauer battery plate, you know, where do you put the unit? So, you know, we have a smaller units now that, you know, have a 1/4-20 mount on them. You can even mount them to a DSLR or a smaller camera. And size is important. And, you know, one of the challenges is a lot of you guys are probably guys and gals or engineers that, when you shrink things, heat dissipation becomes more challenging. When something is larger, you can put a heat sink on it or have fans on it. And you know, in a production environment, fans usually make noise, so the unit has to be silent on a quiet set. So shrinking it presents challenges in thermal management, and Abbey West has solved all these problems in making a smaller package. And one of the challenges of HEVC in particular is the chipsets run a lot hotter. You know, there's a lot more processing going on, more power consumption. So those are some of the challenges that have been addressed and overcome.
I'm glad you brought up HEVC. That was sort of my next question in regards to how I think both cellular and compression have both worked in tandem or have worked in certain rates, you know, to help advance your business. In regards to the compression, HEVC, in the early days, all you could expect was a standard definition picture. And everybody does news in high definition now. When did that come along and what spurred that? George?
So we're talking about HEVC, right? Yeah. So we came out with HEVC this last year, and last year actually with our LU 600 model. And what really spurred that is just making sure it was really, I think, the industry that was spurring it, and technology finally evolved enough in the hardware side that we could offer it. And it's a high efficiency code at H.265. It allows you to essentially stream more data at better bit rate, if you will, lower bit rate, and it's more efficient than an H.264 codec. And one of the things that's nice about the LiveU products is that we're always on HEVC encoding. We do hardware encoding, so it gives you it's a cooler operation, so that's one thing that's important. It's always HEVC all the time, so you're not switching back and forth between multiple codecs. Gives you longer battery life, which is important. And then also, one of the things that we were able to adopt when we moved to HEVC was the ability to stream in H.265, which everybody wants because they want the ability to get that better bandwidth and be able to stream at that codec. But we can also record the feed at H.264, which is an editable format, which everyone, if you're using Adobe or Avid or Final Cut, you want to edit your files possibly. And today you can't edit in H.265. Unless there's some new fangled thing that I don't know about. But that's really what H.265 and HEVC is all about, is much more high efficient codec, gives you the ability to stream much more data or more hours or gigabytes on a data plan than an H.264 codec does. And it's just a much nicer looking codec, and people have been wanting that for a while.
One of the challenges that Comrex had when we were looking at all of the H.265 encoder decoders that were out there was finding one that was actually an encoder decoder, not just an encoder, because our customers have come to expect the two-way video and audio that we offer. And so finding an H.265 encoder decoder that wouldn't burst into flames was not something that we were able to do. Because one of the things that we don't want to do is put a big fan in a product that's up by a camera operator's head, because it'll suck in dirt and debris and make noise. So I think we're, in terms of H.265, we're looking at a different product that you might see at a large trade show in the not too distant future, but I can't really speak more on that at this point. But we think it's interesting, but for what we're doing with the two-way audio and video, the H.264 encoder decoder that we're using seems to be the most efficient. And I was reading an article, it might have been in TV Technology, about how H.264 is not going away because it still has its use. I think H.265 will be useful in some regards, but for our purpose, not so much.
Thank you.
You can go.
Okay.
Thanks, Fred.
Something George said resonated with me, that you can't edit with H.265 or HEVC. Another challenge is most of the CDNs, if you're going to the web, don't support 265 yet. So the Avi West solution is we do transcoding in our transceiver box. We call our receiver a stream hub because it's not only an input, it's more than a receiver. You know, it can take IP inputs, it can bring in the bonded cellular streams, but also can transcode and encode and connect to the CDNs. Another interesting fact is that not all HEVC codecs or chips are the same. There's chips at varying price points, et cetera. What our customers have found, they'll take all of our products, even non-bonded cellular type encoder products, and they'll run them through the, you guys know the Sarnoff Labs test, that test pattern that's supposed to break encoders?
With the lobster.
Lobster two thing. And then Video Clarity makes a box that gives the stream a grade. You feed the source video into the box, and then the video coming out of the encode and decode, or out of the transmission, and it gives it a grade. So what our customers have found is that with 264, the rule of thumb was like 6 or 8 megs was respectable for HD. It's kind of the rule of thumb. I believe that the default setting on the Avi West box is 6 megs with H.264. So most broadcasters are saying we'll run HEVC at 3 or 4 megs, basically cut it in half. Well, using the Sarnoff Labs test and this video clarity test, our customers have found that they get the same quality at 2 megs or less than what they get at 3.5 or 4 megs with some of the other HEVC encoders. So it's the efficiency or the quality of the chipsets, the encoder and decoder that you're using are important. And if you're on a dedicated circuit where you're not being charged by the megabit, who cares whether you're running at 2 megs or 3 megs or 4 megs? But when cellular or satellite is involved, where there's a meter running on how much data you're using, if you can save 30, 40, 50, 60% on your data usage, that can be significant, and our customers seem to like that.
Fred?
Okay, so H.264 and H.265, the difference is one, obviously. H.264 came out in the early 2000s, advanced video codec. I was working for Harris at the time. Transitioning here when H.265 came out, we had ours in the pack like 2 years ago. So. Just kidding. We do our own development on that H.265 codec as well as the H.264 codec. So a lot of what we're doing, and the only thing that I guess you guys don't really care about H.264, H.265, except for in the transmission of the data, it allows it to get through the network in a more efficient manner back to wherever it's going to be received, so you can actually see HD video. We were in a trade show similar to this not too long ago, and inside the venue, we were getting like maybe 1 meg out, maybe up to 3. It was low was 1, high was 3. So we're sitting there with a camera, HD camera, hooked up to a transmitter, and we're transmitting back to Raleigh, North Carolina, and pulling the video back into this to the trade show, and we're getting video out. We got HD video out. Well, we got video out. We got HD video back. So that's the efficiency of H.265 compared to 264, which we would not have been able to get out. And the switchable capability, like you were talking about before, H.264 is not going away. There are applications where it makes sense to use H.264. There are applications where it makes sense to use H.265. So we kind of give you guys the choice of what do you want to use, what do you want to get, what's better for you, what's better for your workflow, your environment, wherever you are, to use that capability. But H.265 is a new codec early on. It's going to be improved much over the next few years, just like H.264 has been. So, and take with the new technology developments.
Right. Thanks, Fred. You know, I think it can be fair to say the broadcasters really didn't want to commit themselves to this technology until it matched or was better than the reliability and the latency of microwave. Have we achieved that? And if we have achieved that, what's the next improvement online? What's the next improvement? I mean, and have we achieved that? Have you guys achieved that? You've matched or bettered microwave.
Yeah, from Live View's perspective, I believe we have. We've matched it or achieved better than microwave in the respect of like latency and delay. So for in a Live View environment, I'll let the others speak for their environment, we're down to on a delay setting 0.6, so it's sub-second delay. So that's better than what you'll get in a standard typical environment like that. So you know, when you start talking like that, though, you also need to realize you do give up some things. You're not able to apply what we call LRT or Live View Reliable Transport, which is things like packet ordering and forward error correction and other technologies that make the signal look better and better. So for example, for our broadcasters, we have a large percentage of broadcasters using our technology. When they're doing talkback and interviews on CNN or CBS or whatever, they usually set the delay to about 1.2 seconds in the field. Most people go, what? Why wouldn't they set it to 0.6, right? The lowest possible delay. Well, because you want to have that error correction and those things in the signal usually to happen sort of on your feed. And it seems to be an acceptable norm, maybe you guys would agree with that, about the delay setting when doing talkback for interview. But others like to bring it down as far as possible and they roll the dice sometimes depending on where they're at. So I think we're there in terms of that technology, and also, you know, with 5G technology, we've done some testing with 5G. We just did, or you're getting to that, right? So I don't want to overshoot. Hold on, I'll hold back on that. But I think for the reliability, talking about satellite or microwave, I think we're definitely there, and can either compete or replace at this standpoint.
I kind of think that microwave is just another tool for the toolbox, especially if you're in a big crowded stadium where you've got 80,000 people using cell phones. You can't really expect that your cellular bonded device is going to work perfectly every time. Whereas microwave is actually probably a better solution for wireless cameras inside of a stadium doing scoreboard stuff, or that, you know, that's why.
All in that case.
Yeah. So I don't think that it's that we've achieved something better than them. I mean, cellular has, or IP codecs have their place. You get to places that you can't get with microwave. So now I can be Sky Italia broadcasting from Times Square back to Rome. I can't necessarily do that with microwave.
It's a little far.
Yeah, a little far.
Well, to dovetail what Chris just said, that we obviously are big on bonded cellular, but you bring up a great point that inside a stadium, if somebody was using a bonded IP or cellular product, 1 second delay and you're singing the national anthem, I think that's going to be ridiculous, you know, to the PA system and the screen. So, you know, Vidovation being an integrator, reseller, we have some microwave solutions from another partner called Avion Air, and the latency is subframe, 7 milliseconds. So we have that mix. In a lot of applications that we do, some of our customers, like a Game Creek, might use the microwave to get from the field to the truck, and then cellular, and then there's a production switcher in the truck. Then a single cellular product or bonded IP product is used to get the produce show out of the venue. So there's always a hybrid, that there's always a mix. And back to what you said, George, that the Aviwest products, we can go down to about a half a second latency, but that's being kind of aggressive. And the Achilles heel is the cellular networks. I'm sure you guys have seen, you know, your gear, and I'm sure you have a latency indicator on your products, Aviwest does. And, you know, typically it's about 50 to 60 milliseconds latency on these cellular connections, but you'll suddenly see it spike to 3,000. You know, like, what just happened? Why did that connection, you know, all of a sudden go out the window? So I think with 5G, there's provisions for low latency services. 5G is going to be using a technique known as slicing. So we'll talk more about that later. So I think we're kind of at the limit based on the 3G, 4G, LTE networks, that 5G will allow us to get the latency. You know, ideally everybody wants it at zero, right? But I think we're kind of at the theoretical limit right now, and hopefully 5G will help solve that.
When do you think, I would say my best question, you know, the most, you know, buzzworthy question at the end in regards to 5G. It's very much hyped right now. And in fact, a couple of years ago when we approached some of you guys about 5G, there was a lot more skepticism. Is that skepticism still there? And I guess, you know, what impact will 5G have on this technology? Fred?
I'll go. I think 5G is going to be the next step in cellular, right? I don't think it's going to be revolutionary. I think it's an evolutionary product. I think it's an evolutionary capability. I think if you think about the way bandwidth, anybody live around, who lives here? Raise your hand. If you live here, raise your hand. Okay. Does anybody remember when 495 had fewer lanes than it has now? Yes? Okay, great. Does anybody remember when the traffic, when they put another lane on there, got any better? No. Once we get more capability with 5G, we're going to figure out how to use it.
It's not, it's technology
just,
hates a vacuum.
What's that?
It hates a vacuum.
Yeah, I know, it does. And that's the same thing that's going to happen. There's no difference between a highway and more bandwidth with 5G. The best thing about 5G is the density in urban areas. So you will get connectivity that you cannot get now, okay? But as far as bandwidth goes, it's going to be utilized. And the bandwidth going up is not that revolutionary at all. It's virtually the same as the bandwidth up on 4G.
Right.
The bandwidth down is going to be a boon for all you guys that want to send stuff to my kids on their damn cell phones.
But that doesn't help us.
No, yeah. It doesn't.
One of the problems of 5G, though, is the frequencies that they plan on using. They're talking 30 gigahertz to 300 gigahertz, which means no building penetration, which means no signal propagation, which is why, you know, look at what T-Mobile did. They went and they bought all that 600 megahertz frequency so they could basically download all of their data service onto the 600 megahertz spectrum, so they have building penetration. You know, the 5G is basically a congestion avoidance scenario for the urban areas where you've got a lot of repeaters, a lot of microcells, and a lot of people on devices that need to be able to get data. Once you get out of that environment, it's not going to be as useful because you have to have a small cell repeater every 5 to 1200 feet in order to make 5G work in its current iteration. And we're still a long way from 5G, regardless of the Verizon commercials that are on there saying, I'm in Houston and it's great. I'm in Dallas and it's great. I'm in New York and it's great. Well, if you move 2 feet, it's not great. If you get onto a bus, it's not great. You lose the signal. If you walk into a building, forget about it. So 4G isn't even fully specified, fully implemented yet. So until they do that, we're seeing an improvement on 4G technology, 4G LTE. 5G, the final specification isn't due to be released until 2023, 2024, and that's part 17, we're on part 15 now. There's still a lot of work that the 3GPP is doing. And the chipsets and the technology and the radios and the handsets don't quite exist yet. We got a long way to go before 5G is going to be useful, and I think industry and enterprise is going to see it before broadcast is going to see it, in my opinion.
This was my favorite question. I've been waiting for this one all day, so thank you for asking it finally. I agree with both everything that Chris said and Fred said. It is going to be a long ways off, but we've been working, LiveU's been partnering with AT&T for the last 2 years on this and have been in their lab and working with them for a while. And we see it a little bit differently, that it is going to roll out quickly and much more faster for the sports world than it is for everybody else. And you guys might agree with that, maybe not. But we worked with them over the summer with the NBA Summer League and actually did a full broadcast that went to air using our LiveU Smart, which is our phone application on AT&T phones with 5G transmitters, the phones that had the 5G built in the stadium that they were doing the Summer League. And they used five of these phones around the stadium in broadcast with the standard complement of what they normally put out at an NBA game. And the reason for this was the NBA wants to, they saw people at every single game using their phones and recording content. And then they realized they were posting this content on their Facebook page and the YouTube page. And they wanted to start getting more fan engagement and wanted to come up with a way of doing this fan engagement. And one of the ways of doing that is using their 5G network. And they have, in a majority of stadiums around the country, 5G networks built in. AT&T has quite a few of those. So I think you're gonna see a very quick addition of 5G in these sports stadiums, sports scenarios where it can be handled. And you're right, for our products, we're implementing 5G in January, but it's a hybrid type of scenario where we're using the AT&T modems that are able to, when you're inside where 5G can't get out through the walls, it switches to 4G LTE. But then when you go out and you're in that 20-foot zone where there is a 5G antenna somewhere, it'll turn on and it'll go to 5G for those couple of modems that will be active. It's non-5G related, but it's also an interesting step towards that, which I think others will be adopting in the future, possibly. Where we also have what are called DTM priority SIMs in LiveU's world.
And those are also made by AT&T. So you have your regular cell phone, right? Everybody has a cell phone like this. And if you're at a stadium event, like we were mentioning before, bandwidth is finite. It gets sucked dry because everybody's trying to stream. Well, if you have a priority SIM, you get a next level prioritization on that network to get your shot out. And when you look at AT&T or some other manufacturers, they have three levels, right? You'll have your regular cell phone SIM, this DTM priority SIM, and then they have what's called FirstNet, which is for first responders only, like police, fire, rescue. So by adding these other DTM SIMs to your plans, you could actually be in a stadium situation where bandwidth is just crunched down to nothing and still be able to get your shot out. So I think in agreement with Chris and Fred, this evolutionary process is going to happen, but I think there's going to be these other smaller steps that might occur with DTM SIMs. Sports is going to be a huge adopter first or early on, and there might even be some other industries that come to fore in addition to sports before it gets to the masses, like you were saying, later in the 2023 or whenever.
Thanks, George. And just a reminder, actually, our next session at 2:15 will be addressing the impact of 5G. We've only got a couple minutes left, so I wanted to open the floor for questions.
That was easy.
Okay. Last question, then. Kind of just describe in a brief, a minute, or even less a minute, some of the most unique use cases that you've seen of your gear so far.
One of the most unique use cases is this live reality TV shows we've been doing. And basically, the A&E channel took the show Cops and said, hey, why don't we do the show Cops, but do it live? And early on, they tried like the Tour de France method, where you had a chase helicopter and you'd be in microwave from a vehicle moving to a helicopter, and then it's hit some ENG microwave receive site, but that wasn't scalable. Or if you had two cop cars in close proximity, and then you had two helicopters, so, you know, and it's $100,000 an hour to run a helicopter. So let's try to do this over cellular. And the challenges of multiple cameras in a police vehicle, or if two vehicles showed up on a scene, the whole Genlock and Remy model really came into play. So that's kind of a crazy live cop show application that we've thrived on.
Thanks, Jim. Chris?
I've got two, but I'll make them very brief.
Okay.
We have a CBS O&O television station down in Dallas that actually uses our device for weather. So they have the rack mount, they put it in a big Suburban. Weather guy goes out into the weather at a shopping center or at the edge of a hurricane. He pulls out a 55-inch flat screen out of the back of the thing, and basically they blow the whole weather package out to the truck, and he has a 7-day forecast and lag, Doppler radar, and Fort Worth tower cam, and he's doing his weather in front of it. And on the same link, they send that whole shot back to the studio. So it's kind of crazy. The other one was, I still don't believe that we did this, but there was a 14-city movie premiere out of Los Angeles where they wanted to have social media likers or influencers in each of these theaters, interviewing movie stars from the movie and basically having the world premiere happening from Los Angeles. So we had 14 racks in Los Angeles and then one in New York and San Francisco and Chicago and Nashville. And they were basically going to every city doing two-way video, which they would then put up on the big screen through the digital projector. And it was crazy. It was a half hour, the most intense live production that I'd ever been involved with. That was crazy.
Great. Thanks, Fred.
So this is a kind of, is this thing working?
Yes.
It doesn't sound like I can't hear myself back here. I need a monitor.
Your voice is on.
Your jet. Yeah.
Okay, how about this? Is that better?
Half the bass.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't do that. I don't have that voice, man. Come here. You do it.
Yeah, that mic's better. That mic's hotter.
How about
much hotter.
Battery's good on that one, too. So everybody's got a Remy product, right? So one of the, if you usually think of how Remy works, right? It's a bunch of cameras over here. Studio back here, bunch of feeds coming in, plugs in the internet, goes back to studio produces the show. It's normally the way it works, right? So one of our customers is AT&T Sportsnet. They run our Remy product in an inverse fashion, because they have another 1 year lease on their vehicles, on their master control vehicles that they're using for sports production. So what they do is, from the studio where they have their talent, they mix back to their production truck using the Remy in an inverse manner. So they go from the studio back to the truck to produce the talent back at the studio, conversing with the guys in the set on the field. So it's kind of an interesting turnaround on how you think Remy works. It's just the inverse.
All right. And I have six, but I'll make it real quick. No. The one that just comes to mind, Los Angeles Fire Department uses about seven of our units. And what they use them for is to do public relations, but mostly it's used for fire emergencies. So they've had a ton of fires this year. And what they do is they take the units out in command vehicles. They take them out on motorcycles, on bicycles. They connect them to GoPros and other types of cameras. And they send two feeds back to their command center, which is at the mayor's office, where they have about 300 people watching on a massive big screen TV. And they make command and control decisions where people are supposed to be going, where they deploy all the fire people to put out the fires. And they also, at the same time, send the signal out to the mobile command vehicles, so the actual fire chiefs, I think is the right term, on the scene at different locations of the fire actually can have tactical control and communication from the main head end to where those people are on scene at the actual fire locations. So similar to, again, another Remy situation, but the fire folks are out there with the packs doing all of the stuff at the fire, putting, you know, location where we need to move troops or folks, firefighters, etc. All right, thank you. Let's give our panelists a round of applause. Great discussion on a technology that's only going to get more ubiquitous, I think. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Great
thank you,
Mark.
Good,
Michael.
Thank you. Thank you.
Chris?